Air breathe, air blow, make this wheel of magic go, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye. Water bubble, water boil, make this wheel of magic toil, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
Hi folks, welcome to Earth
Without,
Radio.
Earth Within, make this wheel of magic spin, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
And to Magical Musings with Joy and Brian. Tonight's show, we're going to be talking about...
Fire blaze, fire burn, make this wheel of magic turn, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
I have got
tonight
to
we're talking
that.
About we're talking about the common myths and misconceptions about or supported by paganism. So.
Yeah, and most of these seem to, from my experience, seem to come in misconceptions in Wicca. So it's going to look like we're picking on Wicca. We're really not. A lot of them have also creeped over into things like Druidry and general just witchcraft. And we're going to try to focus on the pan-pagan myths rather than specifically ones from one tradition or another. As part of all of this, let's go ahead and promo the site. If you don't know about it, but you're listening to this live, we do have a website that you can go to that all these shows are archived on. It's magicalmusings.net, all one word, no K in it anyplace. We have a blog post there. There's some articles. We have the old Tarot Talk shows that are up there. And a contact form, because we are selling ad space for everything, so, you know, to help support all of this, because nothing in this universe is free, unfortunately.
This is true. Yeah. Joy and I each have our own blogs and, you know, email addresses. If you feel like getting a hold of us during the show and you're not signed up with Blog Talk Radio, if, by the way, you are, you can join us in the chat room where we can field questions or, you know, get your involvement in the discussion. If you want to call in to the show tonight, it's 646-564-9966, and that number is based out of New York City, I believe. So it will be long distance. Unfortunately, we haven't got the wherewithal just yet to afford a 1-800 number, but we're working on it. And with your donations, that will very much help us. We'll be
and
able
one
to
of the other
those.
Things that we're
go ahead.
Okay. One of the other things we're trying to work on is to get off of Blog Talk Radio, not because the service is bad, but because of the complexity of having to go through Skype to do the podcast in the first place, and then added on the layer of Blog Talk Radio, and then also the various recording options and chat rooms and everything else, it slows both of our computers down really, really badly. And unfortunately, it just starts causing more problems than it solves. So while I like the service and, you know, we really appreciate them for doing all this, we're trying to get something set up so that we're all on all on our own server and doing the podcast straight from the website. So do come there, favorite it, bookmark it, come back often. I try to make at least one post the day of the new broadcast to let everybody know what's coming up. So if you sign up for our newsletter there, you'll at least get the notification a few hours ahead of time so you can make a few adjustments. But typically what we have is a two-hour podcast every Thursday night. Some of the holidays that are coming up, we're going to be skipping them because people are going to be busy. But we will be having one next week on Samhain itself. So tune in for that one. It's going to be an interesting show. That all that said, and all the sponsorship and the advertising out of the way, now we're just going to get straight into the topic of the night. And as Brian said, it is myths of paganism. One, we've got a whole list here, so we're going to go down these, and we're going to talk about various points. We may not dwell a whole lot on any one thing, but there's more than enough research out there to be able to verify just about anything that we say. The first one that we've got a note about is that the Necronomicon is a powerful mystical grimoire that is going to change your life when you read it, and you'll get your brain sucked into another dimension and it will be eaten, and oh man, I have heard every kind of warning. Yeah, I've heard every kind of warning that ever. Somebody said that they used it as a book to do a whole ceremony of being introduced to gates and the guardians of the gates, and it was. Folks, let me tell you something. The Necronomicon was written as a supplemental book to the Lovecraft books. Lovecraft wrote this as part of it. People enjoyed the Cthulhu series so much, they wanted something extra. So he sat down and using that as a template, he came up with the Necronomicon, okay? It is a book.
And it's
and
a
it
fun
has
book.
Exact, yeah,
it's
it is.
A fun read.
It has exactly
it really
as
is.
Much. It has exactly as much power as you give it. Okay, it if you read through it and you get some inkling of something out of it that makes sense in your mind and you want to incorporate that into your belief structure, hey, go for it. But it's not evil. It's not going to eat you. There's no demons that are going to drag you off to hell one night on the Friday the 13th with a blue moon in the sky, which confidentially is never going to happen. It's just
yeah.
Okay.
Actually, it's
and
funny because I remember. Sorry, mm-hmm. I was just thinking about how in the early days of the internet, you know, back in the days when you had to dial up to a bulletin board system to connect. To chat with people or whatever, there was a website or a BBS service that I used to hang out with all the time, and there was discussions on there almost every night that someone would say that the Necronomicon was an Illuminati conspiracy or that, you know, it was terrible evil and all this kind of stuff. And I remember being, you know, like a teenager and just thinking, I'm going to read this because it's got to be interesting if it's causing this much controversy.
Mm. Believe it or not, authors have very, very creative brains. I write stories myself. And you have to have a natural creativity in order to create this entire world that people love. Because, I mean, think about it. You're taking a concept that has never been around before. It could have been around. You are adding your characters in there. Those characters are doing things that you want them to. You're adding in scenery and you're adding in all of this other stuff, okay? And not only that, you're naming everything as well, okay? This is an immense amount of creativity. So, yes, when you get a fiction book, it's going to have elements that resonate with you. There's no avoiding it. And if that's good, great. Pull it out. Use it as part of your belief structure. But don't think that everything in one book, for instance, the Necronomicon, for instance, the Lovecraft documents, for instance, the Screwtape letters, for instance, Mercedes Lackey's works with the Guardians, is real. Because first off, if it were, and some author sat down and wrote it all out, absolutely true, and then published it as fiction, they'd be stupid. Because if it were real, they would not only be condemning themselves, but hundreds of thousands of other people who believed it. Okay?
True.
So if it's fiction, treat it as fiction. Enjoy it for what it brings to you. Enjoy it for the distraction. But don't put your entire brain into the basket of nuts that is a book, a work that is designed to earn the author money. Because at the end of the day, it's not about political statements. It's not about talking about how Queen Victoria did this or had this lover. It is about paying your rent. Okay. So we're going to move on to there to a related myth. And that one's the one about Ouija boards are going to take over your soul. Okay. Unfortunately, my wife, Mary, tends to suffer from this one and won't let a Ouija board in the house anywhere. Along with it being a game, it's published by Parker Brothers, the same people that brought you Monopoly and Sorry and several others. Now, people out there are going to say, no, no, it's a conspiracy. It's a way for demons to get in. You know what? You can use it that way, and there's certainly nothing stopping you from using it to channel spirits and talk to them. But out of the factory floor, onto the shelf at the store, it is a big cardboard with a piece of plastic on it. And some
That's
lighting.
True. Although it is a lot of fun at parties.
Oh, it is. It's great fun. I scared the living flip out of myself when I was younger because we start screwing around with a Ouija board, and I thought the thing was moving on its own, and it might have been, but I don't know. And it spelled out, you know, this word, and I didn't know what the hell it was. But, you know, it can be whatever. It's a good channel for your own unconscious. You can use it as a means of doing what's called automatic writing, and that's where you sit on a chair with a notepad underneath your writing hand, a pen in that hand, and you go into a meditative state. And you don't try to control your arm. You just let your arm and hand move, however. And occasionally a helper will turn the page so that you're writing more. And then you look at what's scribbled there because it's going to be scribbles. It's going to be chicken scratch. And you might be able to find cruciform in there. You might be able to find Theban runes or something like that. But it's going to be a way to channel your subconscious thoughts out through your hand without your conscious mind getting in the way. Okay, that's what a Ouija board does. All right. One of the big concerns is that because this is a divinatory tool for the Ouija board, that you are inviting a spirit that's connected to the board in through all of your protections, and it's going to you have no way of getting rid of it once it's done, okay? If that's a concern, then I would say most witches who are using it and that's happening to don't know what the hell they're doing in witchcraft, because shielding is one of the very first lessons you ever learn. You learn how to protect yourself. Okay. Sure. Yes, you are inviting another spirit into the circle with you. Okay, but you are inviting them. Okay, the portals of hell are not going to open up and spew out demons because you put a piece of plastic on a piece of cardboard. Okay, and let me also be very, very specific about this. Plastic is a magical insulator. Okay, it does not transmit magical anything through it. If
cardboard,
you ever tried
on the other hand, gateway to hell.
Okay, so when you're using the Ouija board as a channel, okay, the magical impulses are not going to go through that plastic. If you've ever tried to enchant a printer so that it works, you know how hard that is, and that's because the plastic itself, along with rubber, along with glass, and a number of other things is an insulator, okay? The same insulators that you have in electricity are the same insulators you have in magic, because the energies involved are almost identical, okay? Mm-hmm. So if you're using rubber as an insulator in your electrical work, the rubber is also going to be an insulator when you try to do magic through it. You're not going to be able to, okay? So because the Ouija board has the planchette, I think it is, made out of plastic, it's not going to work yep. like that. Now, all that being said, older boards, older witch boards, one's carved out of bone, one's burned into wood, one's with silver rings that you've had from your grandmother, those actually do work because of the materials, because of the belief, because of the energies involved. If I took a piece of paper and wrote out A to Z on it and put all the numbers and put a big yes and big no on this, and I took my great-grandmother's wedding ring, nice, beautiful piece of gold, and I sat down with Mary over a table, and we both touched it and asked a question, great-grandma's probably going to show up and answer it, because that item is tied to her energies. And even if she doesn't show up as a soul because she's reincarnated or whatever, the energy is still going to react the way she would have. Okay? So
which does actually bring up a point.
Okay,
sorry,
go ahead.
You mentioned that communicating with spirits through a spirit board. In that sense, actually, if you do connect with someone that you've known in a previous or during your life, or you know who has existed in a past life, keep in mind that being dead doesn't make you a genius. Okay, the soul only survives, you know, only retains the knowledge, you know, of a life and brings that forward. So if you do connect with a spirit of some sort, keep in mind they don't know everything just because they've died.
And they're also going to still have their same personality. Okay?
This is true.
Because like Ryan was saying, the soul itself may be eternal, but the spirit, which is the personality and the data and the knowledge that they accumulated during their lifetime, is still going to be the same. Okay? That is finite. It ends upon death when there's no longer any sensory input. And then it gets put into the way I wound up describing it is, okay, your soul is a hard drive. And on that hard drive, it has hundreds of thousands of files. Well, each of these hundreds of thousands of files is a lifetime that they live. Okay, now when you start adding in quantum physics and stuff and talking about multiple lifetimes and might have been and stuff, they're on there too, okay? But when you connect with somebody and their spirit is coming through, what you're going to get is you're going to get the overall gestalt of that personality from amongst hundreds of thousands, if not millions and billions of choices and lifetimes that were led, okay? And it's going to be, if this person was 85% an asshole during those trillions of lifetimes, they're going to be an asshole when you connect to them, okay? So you can't automatically assume that they've got your best interest at heart, that they even know the answer to the question, or anything like that. They're just another spirit that's wandering around. Okay.
Drifting in the ethers.
Oh. Yeah. okay, on a related note, reading tarot cards and you lock yourself into that future by reading that future in your reading. What I'm not explaining this right, but the myth is that when you do a tarot spread for yourself, that you lock in that future until you can't get out of it. So whatever comes up in there is absolutely 100% going to happen. I can tell
so
you
it's
that
like
this is
self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, there's the myth is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, but I can tell you right now that it is absolute crap, because one time I did a spread for myself, I saw myself getting great amounts of wealth coming into my life, and the great amounts of wealth that came into my life at that point was a $500 paycheck. And I'm sorry, I didn't consider that great amounts of wealth. Yeah, this was, talking about wealth on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's like,
well,
okay, so that one doesn't work. The time stream, as I've explained in other shows, is fluid, okay? Yes, while you're up in the time stream and you're seeing it directly, it looks very linear, point A to point B to point C to point D, okay? But Doctor Who was right. It's actually a big ball of timey-wimey stuff, okay? it's the only way that you get things locked in is with quantum mathematics and the fact that anytime you come to a choice of some sort, you choose what you choose, but some version of you in another universe makes all the other choices that you couldn't. So any decision tree where you decide, well, let's take one from today. I was having a really bad day. I didn't feel good. I was on the verge of canceling tonight's show and just going, screw it. Well, I decided not to. But in some other universe, a part of me did. In another universe, did cancel the show. In another universe, somebody, the joy there, called Brian and said, you do the show tonight. And every other possible choice at that point was made. And thus you had this fan of timelines that come off. Okay? So you may see a future for you. And it's going to be chosen, but it's not necessarily by you.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're going into, quantum level reality where plurality of dimensions, are simultaneously existing and playing out. And, it's all fascinating stuff. But ultimately it comes down to this. Whatever future you read in a divination tool of any kind isn't necessarily a fixed destination.
Right. The reason that they weren't warn against it all the time, people that teach these things, is not because it's a fixed destiny, but it's because you're probably interpreting whatever you're seeing wrong.
That's true.
Mainly because you're too close to the situation. And you're seeing what you want to into the cards instead of what the cards are actually telling you.
Yes, okay. That's very true. And
all
that
right.
is
and
something that people
now,
do.
Oh, yeah. They do it all the time. It's wishful thinking, wish fulfillment, and on and on and on. More myths, and this is three that are kind of related. And I lay the blame for these three entirely at New Age mysticism's doors. A, Atlantis did not exist. B, Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster, is not a real creature. And C, Bigfoot was a hoax. Okay. Now, what these have to do with paganism, you got me. One's an island that sank because of a volcanic whatever. It's mentioned twice in the overall body of knowledge that we have. And people have been going crazy trying to find it ever since. I've heard that it's, in the Bermuda Triangle, that it's off the coast of Malta, that it's in the middle of the Atlantic, that it's actually one of the islands in the Mediterranean. And on and on and on. Pick a theory and you probably got it. If Atlantis did exist, and I'm saying if because the actual evidence we have of it, like I said, is two mentions in somebody's book that they wrote back during when Greece was the huge superpower of the world.
True.
And that's it. There's no other evidence anyplace. There would be artifacts from Atlantis. There would be trade items from Atlantis. There would be flotsam and jetsam from Atlantis. There would be, people are discovering 500-year-old sunken Spanish galleons with hundreds of millions of doubloons, dollars in doubloons on there, you know, and nobody's found anything about Atlantis. We found 98% of the contents of the Library of Alexandria after it sunk in Memphis. I think it was Memphis. No, Alexandria. And
that makes sense.
You know, we don't have anything from Atlantis, okay? Now, it's possible that there was a civilization that called itself Atlantis, okay? I'm not going to debate that. Civilizations rise and fall all the time. It's also, you know, said that Moses, the Ark of Noah, wasn't a worldwide, planet-wide event. It was a local event in the Mediterranean basin. And, you know, on the scale that they're looking at, you know, that's worldwide for them.
Well, to be fair, I mean, there's evidence of cities and of, you know, the shores of the Mediterranean stretching beyond their old boundaries. And, you know, there are little bits of evidence that, you know, something has happened in the Mediterranean region that, you know, there are civilizations that were lost technically through monsoons or what have you. Mm-hmm. Not monsoons. What the hell is that word? Tidal waves. Tsunamis. That's the word.
Tsunami.
Now, my personal favorite theory, and the one that I think holds the most water, is the idea that the lost Cretan civilization was actually nicknamed Atlantis in, you know, Plato's retelling of the story.
Or it could have been, you know, that they actually did call themselves Atlanteans, you know, because what people know of civilization by is not necessarily what the civilization called themselves.
That's very true as well. And, I mean, realistically, too, there's been arguments that the story of the 10 plagues in the Bible actually relates to the explosion of Thera, or Santorini, I guess. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that, you know, these things that sounded really impossible are actually sequential
events. Now
explain
what that was.
okay, well,
that's a volcano, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea is that Santorini, or what I believe is now called the island of Thera, I'm told it means fear, but I don't know for sure. It used to be a full island with a developed civilization on it, but some 6,000, 10,000 years ago, there was a volcanic eruption that just basically blew the island apart. And
mm-hmm.
what you end up with is the events obviously coming after that being something, you know, like tsunamis that would spread from that island base, you know, out to the nearby shores of the Mediterranean, and, you know, different effects happening because of this. So you've got like the plagues of you've got the plagues in the Bible being described as things like infestation of locusts. Now, realistically, I mean, a plague of locusts, any sort of insect by instinct is going to try and escape from vast explosions of gases and ash that, you know, happen that basically black out the sun. So that's a very realistic sort of thing. You've got like things like plagues of frogs coming up. There's a lot of, or I guess it wasn't in the right order, but, you know, things like boils.
No, you got
death.
It. Got it right.
You know, all these other events
boils
that happen.
Boils and death, you know. Yeah.
mm-hmm. and flies.
Yeah, and I saw that too. I think the order it wound up coming in was the sky was darkened, and then the Nile turned to blood, and the explanation there was the ash got in there and mixed with some of the minerals that were in the Nile naturally, and it all turned red, and would be undrinkable. And then that caused boils and sores and, you know, people getting dehydrated and trying to bathe in this water that's contaminated, which caused the locust plague, which caused the frogs, because they're going to come out of the woodwork and trying to get out of the water, and they're going to be eating all of the everything, you know. And it just it was a cascade effect, and it was, like, really fascinating, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And the idea of... I think in the Bible it was described as ice and fire storm or something like that, you know, and basically it's this idea of burning ash that somehow gets coated by ice in the upper atmosphere and falls to the earth as, you know, like hail, basically. But as the ice melts, there's, like, heat that burns people. Now, the interesting thing with the whole idea of water turning red, you know, speaks to the story of, was it Moses and Aaron? You know, dealing with the Pharaoh and turning the Nile red and all this kind of stuff. And then that, you get into, like, there's this lake in, like, Nigeria or Ethiopia or somewhere that actually had an explosion of gases underneath it that turned the water, like, rust red, like blood, and actually killed a bunch of people. Because this cloud of carbon dioxide swept across the valley, and it like killed everyone in their sleep while they were just, you know, going about their business. And there were people that dropped, you know, mid-step kind of thing, because they were just overwhelmed by the carbon dioxide, which is toxic, obviously, in high levels. So, you know, there's evidence.
And when
that
you stop
suggests,
and sit. Yeah, and when you stop and consider this stuff, you know, it's not really out that far fetched. I mean, Pompeii, there you go.
That's,
you know, essentially the same thing happened. An entire civilization was buried, and there were two eruptions there, not just one. You know, and people were, you know, walking down the street. The gases came down from Herculaneum, and they dropped in as they were taking steps, carrying things. You know, so you're talking about events, and you didn't have the World Wide Web or CNN, so, you know, people in the throne of Egypt are not going to necessarily know that the headwaters of the Nile suddenly had a massive earth fart, which is what it is, and wiped out half the civilization there, and they were about to get destroyed by it too, you know. All they could go by was, okay, we're walking along here, and oh my God, the river's red. What the hell?
Exactly.
You know, going along with that, Bigfoot's was a hoax, okay? People, the guy that, the most famous evidence of Bigfoot was a film of a big shaggy gorilla thing walking away. Okay, it's grainy, it's jumpy, you can't get a good look at it, you can't analyze it, it's like 60 years old, so that the film is falling apart, and the guy that actually was wearing the gorilla suit came forward and said, we staged this. Yet there are still people out there going, no, Bigfoot's real. Okay, I can think of about a dozen things that I would love to have be real, but once somebody says that, you know, okay, this is what's actually happening, I kind of tend to believe them. And given some of the things I've seen in the natural world, you can't really discount what these experts are telling you. I mean,
well,
all the other evidence for
it.
Bigfoot, you know, go ahead.
It's all very anecdotal, and, you know, that tends not to be a solid proof of any sort of thing. Although you get into, like, arguments from Native American groups who, you know, talk about these hairy people, this civilization living in the woods that snatches their children or, you know, what have you. I mean, the Pacific Northwest has a ton of stories like of this like hairy woman who comes along and snatches children and eats them. And, you know, you've got stories from like miners who say that their cabin was attacked by, you know, several large hairy giants, you know, throwing rocks on the roof and all this kind of stuff. But again, it becomes anecdotal evidence, which isn't really proof of anything. There's actually in modern documentaries. Sorry, you're welcome to go ahead.
No, go finish what you're saying.
Well,
this is one of the reasons why we want to get off Blog Talk Radio, because there is this delay there. I'll start saying something and he's talking. So, okay, go ahead, Brian.
That's true. Yeah. Well, there's modern documentaries that talk about Bigfoot and, you know, Sasquatch and whatnot that, you know, there are certain native tribes who believe that Sasquatch or Bigfoot is kind of an interdimensional being or a spirit being who is kind of present as a guardian spirit of the forest. And for me, just because of sort of the pagan nature of my spiritual journey, I tend to like that sort of explanation. It doesn't make Bigfoot any more real for me, but for me, that kind of guardian spirit personality that's been put onto him is a really meaningful sort of approach, because then, you know, you get into stories like Iron John or Iron Hans, if you have read the Grimm version. You get into stories of the Woodwose in Europe, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and the Abominable Snowman, et cetera, and all these hairy giant creatures that, you know, they're fascinating. And, you know, whether they exist or not isn't the issue. It's just the fact that they are featured in stories makes them interesting, makes their stories compelling. I mean, who cares if the footprints are, you know, doubled over bear tracks or whatever? The idea of that hidden mystery in the deep, dark forest is the core of, like, stories and mythologies that humanity has told for centuries, millennia.
Oh, yeah, and I'm not – okay, please understand something. I am not decrying that Bigfoot and Nessie and all of that did in a long time ago past exist, or that there are guardian spirits, okay? I mean, I work with dragons regularly, and I can't find a single dragon skeleton any place on the planet. That's because they collectively got up and moved to the astral plane where they exist now. Okay, same thing with unicorns. And I'm not saying that somebody that's in the right frame of mind wouldn't see a spirit that looks like that. What I'm saying is that they don't have a home on this physical plane now. Okay?
Well, for certain. So, and actually, that's something that Michael Harner alludes to in his book, The Way of the Shaman. You know, he talks about the difference between ordinary consciousness and shamanic consciousness. And he says that you can talk about things like dragons and Bigfoot and unicorns and fairies and stuff, and someone who has experienced the shamanic state of consciousness will understand that you're talking about that astral level of reality as opposed to physical, real-world reality.
Right, but when you have a whole slew of books, I can go to a bookstore and probably point to a shelf of books talking about finding Bigfoot. You know, it gets to be a little bit much. And to have people that are in paganism, I don't care if it's Druidism, shamanism, Wicca, witchcraft, or whatever, put all of their identity and all of their hopes and all their dreams into this being real, and then have it come out that it's not, like he comes forward and says, no, it was a hoax, that's, you know, world-shattering for them. And I've had to work with people to rebuild them back up into a point where they could function again simply because something like that came along. Okay?
That would suck.
It does. It massively does. My grandmother was absolutely devastated when she found out that one of the holy ladies that she had been following for years, upwards to two decades, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, in fact, that was her name, and had donated money to purchase land and was going to move up to wherever this land was and live with her there. When she found out and it came out that Clare Prophet was nothing but a scam artist, she was absolutely destroyed. And then, you know, the greatest scam artist in the world, and I can say this because I'm an ex-Mormon, Mormonism. I mean, here's a guy that built a religion around himself based on the fact that he found a whole bunch of plates beaten out of gold with inscriptions written on them that no one except him could read, with the assistance of a rock that he kept in his hat. And those plates can't be seen by anybody, okay? And then to have it come out later that he was convicted of treasure finding because, get this, a couple of guys got some metal, beat out the coins, scribed a whole bunch of Chinese characters from a tea box, buried it in the ground. He found it and translated it for all of his other stuff, and he was convicted of treasure finding. Now, that kind of makes you go, wait a minute. Did he just do it again?
Well, and I mean, the truth, too, is that, I mean, Smith changed the rules as he went because he had, quote, revelations about things that he just felt, you know, he couldn't get enough, you know, action and decided, well, I've got a friend with a hot girlfriend. I'm going to make her my wife, you know, and he changed the rule. Oh, God told me this. That's true. Moroni said, you know, well, okay, great. Now.
And when you actually start looking at some of the rituals in the temple, because it's leaked out what they do in there, they're identical to Masonic rituals. I mean, down to the oaths and the words said and everything.
Well, I think
and it's like, okay,
pretty obvious. Like, you've got the levels of the priesthood, you know, and they correspond to, like, characters in the Bible and, you know, like, levels in Masonic training and that sort of thing. It's like, well, no, that's a revelation from God. God said everyone should be a Freemason.
And it's kind of interesting that his wife, and I don't remember her name, at one point wrote in her diary that she was getting sick of having to clean up the tobacco juice and people coming to the Sabbath service drunk. And so she was going to talk to Joseph about that and talking to them. And two meetings later, literally, he comes up with a revelation in the middle of this that winds up being what's called the Word of Wisdom, where it forbids tobacco products and forbids alcohol and forbids several other things. You know, it's kind of like, well, the timing there is really screwed. But anyway, okay, moving on.
Changing the rules as he went, anyway.
yes, always. Anyway, okay, this is also linked to the Atlantis and to Bigfoot. Pyramids and Stonehenge, okay? The persistent myths are that the pyramids were built by aliens with tons of slave labor, that Pharaoh was cruel and that he beat people, and that because of the way the pyramids were manufactured, the fact that they're perfectly aligned to the north, that they have these stars that are over top of them once every 5,000 years, and the way the weights are distributed and that it couldn't have been built by humans. okay?
It's true. I mean, I love ancient aliens, but they're not always espousing the truth.
This I love because there was a Nova special a while back where they built a pyramid. And it was a small one. It was only about 40 stones high or so. But all these engineers came out and they went, okay, we're going to build a pyramid with using the technology that they would have had at the time. We're going to use ropes, we're going to use wood, and we're going to use really big stones. First problem we have is how do we orient it to the north? Well, they don't have compasses, okay? So how do we do this? And one of the engineers was listening to all of this and them going back and forth on how to figure out north. And he threw up his hands, and he walked over. He drew a line in the sand, stuck a stick standing straight up, waited, marked something, waited a couple of minutes, marked the shadow, and then using a couple of mathematical things, had true north, perfectly aligned by using the shadow compass that Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts learn.
It's true.
And everybody's like, oh, wow, this is, oh, how did he do that? It's like, this is observable science, okay? And
basic,
then, okay,
yeah.
So we're going to bring in this, you know, we're going to bring in this two-ton block. Well, how will we do that? We don't have any cranes or anything like that. Well, we're going to have to drag it, okay? Well, how will we do that? Well, how about rollers? Okay, so we put down a whole bunch of rollers. We put the block on it, and we pull. And, hey, it rolls along pretty good. Well, now we've got this roller out the back. Okay, well, we'll take it up front and pull it along. And look at this. It's actually moving. We've got 10 people pulling a 5-ton block into place. Wow.
It's true.
You know?
It is true. I mean,
you know,
it's great. Go
people
ahead.
Don't think about, and one of the basic things that they don't also think about is that we as a Western society are spoiled. Because if we want to build a house, we can have that house built in a week, okay? And we think, okay, well, the ancients must have had the same stuff to build it in a week, but they didn't have air guns. So how could they drive the nails? Well, you know what? Hammers work. And just because we can get it in a week now doesn't mean that they didn't take 6 months to put the same structure up.
That's
they
true.
Had time. They didn't have distractions. They didn't have TV. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have 500 things that they were doing at once. They didn't have wristwatches that kept time for them.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, I mean, there's evidence coming to light, too, that the Egyptians weren't using slaves to construct the pyramids. They were using, like,
no, they were volunteers.
Citizens. Yeah, I mean, the idea was that there was a period, you know, during each year that you would basically saunter on down to, like, the capital, and you would put in your time for the year, and that would be, like, the equivalent of paying taxes for the year or whatever. You know, it's easier to get labor done by volunteers than it would be to, you know, drag thousands of slaves. Because just the manpower needed to organize the slave, you know, laborers would be ridiculous. I mean, because you'd have to have everyone. It'd be like compartmentalizing the whole labor system like we do nowadays.
Mm-hmm. And no matter what anyone says, you put enough people on enough ropes, you can drag a 10-ton block across the most gritty, hard surface that you want. It all depends
true.
On how much muscle you have on there. So, yeah, we've got steam shovels that relieve us a lot of that. We don't have to put 200 people on a rope. But let me point out something. The cars that you have, the power of the engine is measured in horsepower. You know how they got that? Horses.
The heck you say? You're crazy now.
Oh,
measuring power by horses?
Crazy. Yes. I mean, you know, same thing with Stonehenge. I mean, Stonehenge is, if you actually look at the archaeology of Stonehenge, it wasn't built in a couple of years. This was a 200-year project. And some of the stones were put in place, and things, and you worshipped in there. And then somebody else put a stone in place so that they could mark this, and then people worshipped there. And then somebody else put in this ring, and then they worshipped there. And there's graves there. You know, the when you think of Stonehenge, all you seem to think about is the big standing stones. Well, that was actually the last thing that was put in place. There are three other rings of temple there that were in place before them.
Very true. And the blue stones that are part of the inner circle now were, you know, like the outer edge, you know, inside the ditch. You know, they've been moved because they had a new purpose. And, you know, there's all kinds of tests and ideas and research that have been going on in the past, you know, even like 20 to 30 years that talks about the way that Stonehenge was built. There's a really great documentary actually called, I think, Stonehenge Decoded, that talks about the
same
like
one.
Iron Age or the ancient like Britons who basically hauled stones from, you know, Wales in years-long journeys, just dragging these
and
things.
And once again,
you know,
once again, you put enough people on a rope, you're going to be able to move it. I mean, they had wagons. They had boats. You drop one of the blue stones onto the boat, you float it down the river, because the nearest river goes only like about 20 kilometers away from where they drop these things. You only have to worry about dragging it 20 kilometers, and you get enough horses in a wagon, you can do it.
Exactly. I mean, it's fascinating. You know, it's fun to think that, you know, some sort of advanced super technology, you know, goes into building these things. The Moai of Easter Island, for instance, you know.
Oh, God.
I mean, there's so many different ones that are credited to aliens, you know, that are just, like, completely oblivious to the potential that our species has had in creating these monster projects, you know, like,
especially
we try to
get... Especially when they're still being done today.
Well, exactly.
I mean, they built one of the Easter Island statues from the same quarries that the original ones were built from. They even put the hat on it like it's supposed to have.
Did they put the eyes in?
You know, yeah, they did.
I love
the whole
eyes.
Thing. You know, and it's like, oh, this goes down hundreds of thousands of feet, and it's actually a person that's buried. And it's like bullshit. You know, the people that are still on the island are like, no, this is, you know, a way of showing, these are like battle trophies. This is what those were. and it's, I get frustrated with stuff like this, because while the myth is great, when people who are saying that the goddess spoke to them personally and shared her knowledge with them get up in on a pulpit or a platform someplace and say, and she told me that the pyramids were built by the spacefaring races, okay, it completely discredits the person speaking, and by association it discredits the rest of us. There was a book not too long ago that I reviewed, written by a Christian, talking about Wiccans, okay, specifically, and trying to explain Wicca to a Christian audience. He did an outstanding job with it. I was thrilled to read and review this book. I gave it my highest rating, 5 stars. I've given that to about 3 of the books that I've read out of the 200 that I've reviewed. Okay, so this is not a small thing. But one of the criticisms he had was that Wiccans cling to these myths that have been discredited over and over and over, and therefore are very out of touch with reality. And to be honest, I can't say he's wrong, because that's exactly what happens. Okay?
Well,
if you want to believe, go ahead.
Sorry, I think people get caught up in the romanticism of these sort of made-up histories, because when you're talking about certain renditions of history. You're dealing with people who might be referring to like 17th century or 18th century writing, or to like writers in the classical era who may have been, you know, gods forbid, actually writing a fiction for public, you know, enjoyment rather than trying to create a historical, you know, rendition of actual fact.
Talking about I just drew a blank on it. The Mists of Avalon.
Well, I mean, among other things, I was basically just referring to like people in general who look to people like Plato. I mean, it's possible that he was just fictionalizing an actual event. We call it historical fiction nowadays, but you know, just because Plato wrote it doesn't mean it's historical fact. You know,
true.
I mean, I could write,
you know,
a long history of, you know, I don't know, my own heritage, you know, and I could trace me back to, shit, I don't know, Atlantis. I could trace me back to, I don't know, some other star system. You know, it doesn't make it true. It just means that I made up some fun stuff, and it sounds really convincing. But you have to be able to sort of separate truth from fiction. You have to be able to say dragons exist on the astral plane. They don't exist now. It doesn't make them untrue. It simply makes them part of the truth in a different reality. Same thing with the idea of shamanic journeying. You know, you're dealing with another level of reality as opposed to the physical one that we are all inhabiting right now. It doesn't make the things that you experienced in those trances untrue. They're simply real in a different reality.
Mm-hmm. And this is a wonderful segue into the next point that I wanted to talk about. I've been seeing on a lot of bulletin boards, a lot of chat lists, a lot of you know, however you want to get together with more than three pagans and talk about paganism. I've been seeing a lot of noise about how if you can't astrally project, you're not really a fill-in-the-blank. Okay, that is complete and utter bullshit. And I wish whoever had come up with this would be infested with the fleas of 10,000 camels in their genitals. Because... something like this, it's far too close to the no real Scotsman fallacy, okay? And the no real Scotsman fallacy basically states that there's a statement made that no real Scotsman would insert whatever here, okay? And for every single person that adheres to that and doesn't do whatever it was, you will be able to find another person who does from that same culture, okay? So saying that no real Wiccan would harm somebody else intentionally, you know, I've been personally harmed by people calling themselves Wiccans. And the answer to that is somebody comes back and says, well, they weren't true Wiccans. You know, and that's BS, because as far as they're concerned, they were true Wiccans. So you can't have a global benchmark like that for people. You simply can't. Astral projection is a skill that is learned over an immense amount of time. I'm going to delve into my personal story here for a little while. My grandmother is, if you want to look at it this way, I'm actually Granny Trad. Because my grandmother was very into New Age mysticism, very into just about every the people that wrote in the Victorian and Edwardian eras during the Great Revival and everything. She studied this stuff. She was a New Age Christian and kind of projected that onto me. I remember very vividly at about 6 years old having a conversation with her about aura colors and whether I could see them or not, okay, and talking to her about what they meant and telling her that, no, I can't see them, but I can feel them. You know, somebody standing there and he's not feeling good, I can feel green coming off of him. And having her explain, well, is it green like grass or is it green like something else? And I'm like, well, it's kind of a yellowish green. It kind of makes me feel sick. And she's, you know, and she's going on about it. I have been practicing astral projection since then. Okay, so we're talking about 40 years of consciously meditating, trying to separate my soul from my body, and move around on the astral plane. And you want to know one of the big secrets? I still can't do it. Okay? Not consciously. I can do it unconsciously while I'm asleep, just like everybody does. I can project my mind into those areas, kind of like daydreaming with a purpose. A lot of people call it pathwalking. But when I do that, I get a sense of what's going on. And when I check with those spirits later through various means, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Whatever it was that I saw happening in my head while I was daydreaming is what actually went on, okay? So saying that you can't be a whatever unless you can do fill in the blank, it's not right. And what it does is it raises a whole bunch of baby pagans who feel like failures. You know,
very true.
I think it was Einstein that said, everyone's a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it's going to spend its entire life thinking it's stupid. And
yes,
that's what
we've
got here. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I mean, that's what we're talking about. Go ahead.
I mean, the simple fact is that each of us is gifted differently, right? So you can't expect that everyone's going to be skilled at astral projection or that everyone's going to be skilled at healing or, you know, Reiki or what have you. The simple truth is we all are different. We all have different gifts. What we should do is discover and cultivate the ones that we do have instead of worrying about the ones that we never, ever develop.
Right. Exactly. And when you're, even though there is instructions in at least Alexandrian, probably in Gardnerian, although I can't say for definite because everybody that actually knows isn't talking, and those that do talk actually don't know because it's oathbound. There's instructions on how to gain the sight and how to astrally project, okay? They work as a meditation, but you need a partner with it, okay? It works in the same way that the old sensory deprivation tanks work, where you're taking away everything except this one sensation. And that's all the brain can focus on at that point, and it starts cannibalizing itself. And, yeah, when you're put in sensory deprivation, you're going to see everything. You're going to feel a connection and a euphoria. There's no way that you couldn't, because it is a matter of your brain craves input. When it's denied input, it will create input just so that it can have it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the same kind of thing that, you know, that happens. I mean, the imagination is a powerful thing. And sometimes we can mistake the projections of our own imaginations as, you know, reality. When in fact, they're just the imagination filling in the blanks. It happens with people who are, you know, meditating. It happens, you know, all over the place. I mean, the simple truth is the imagination has an ability to fill in the blanks if there's nothing to draw from. Like, your imagination can create this fantastic reality of you having walked the gold-paved streets of Atlantis or what have you. But, you know, if Atlantis had gold-paved streets. Gold is not a metal that tarnishes. It does not decompose. It would still be there somewhere, and someone would have found it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so, yeah, and this is one of the reasons why all of the ancient mystics and why the Oracle at Delphi and why people who are practice now say know yourself. It's not just understanding your own psyche and your own ambitions and not lying to yourself about it. It's also knowing what you are creating out of your own brain and what actually is. Because I'll tell mm-hmm. you something, when I actually do project myself onto the astral, okay, and I'm associating with Kitsune and dragons, I can imagine all kinds of things for them and talk to them later, and they'll be going, no, up yours, I'm not doing that, you know, whatever. And or I can just let those impressions come to me. By knowing what is my psyche and what my brain is creating, I'm able to separate those into what actually happened and what I chose to make happen. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have to know that. All right. The next one is solitary and self-dedication. The myth is that you cannot self-initiate, that you can't get close to the gods without having a coven initiation, okay? This is true and not both, okay? It's true you cannot self-initiate. However, you can self-dedicate. And as we talked about in the last episode, the gods are going to do their own initiation, okay?
Exactly.
I had a whole thing that I came up with while I was falling asleep last night for this part that I can't remember right now, so I'm going to be kind of trying to reconstruct it as I go along here.
Fair
enough.
You
can't self-initiate, but you can self-dedicate. And essentially all that is sitting down and in the presence of the gods promising that you are their servant, okay, that you are going to be the best representative of them on the earth that you can possibly be, that you are willing to dedicate your life to not only worshiping them, but doing as they ask, living by principles that they teach, and trying to make the world a better place. Okay, everybody does this. Usually in any religion, when you have that epiphany, that one moment when you're part of everything and you understand more than just a little bit that you can see, and it feels like the Spirit of God has descended upon you, that's usually that same sensation. And that's the dedication. That's where you decide, make a conscious decision that this is what you want to do with your life. Okay. In a solitary format, if you don't have access to a coven, that's all you can do, because that's you promising them that this is what's going to happen, okay? In a coven situation, you're still going to have that same dedication. Usually when you start going to the classes in the outer court, learning about deities, what they want and what they teach. But later on, you're going to get to a point where you're going to be going to the initiation where the priest or priestess or whoever is running this introduces you to the gods and the gods to you and basically makes this mystical connection between you and them and plugs in your deity phone. And it's a transformative experience because you're in an altered state of consciousness while you're going through it. You're anticipating it so much that when you start going through that, you drop into a mindset, ultra receptivity, okay? Normally during these times, the priest or priestess or whoever it is going to give you additional information that you weren't given before. And in some cases, these are called mysteries. Okay. Usually it's things like the deity's names, ways to contact the deities, the fact that by doing this, you are now a priestess or priest of those deities, and now you really have no excuse for screwing up, and so forth and so on. But there's also, you know, other traditional type things. And this, and you get this because you are in an altered state of consciousness, okay? That's great when you have somebody else there to put you in that state of mind. If you are in a solitary situation where you don't have somebody else, you can still get all of that. It's just going to take longer, and it's going to be more of a struggle because the gods are going to do what the gods are going to do, and if they want you to have this information and they want you to be initiated, they're going to do it, period. You got no hope. And so, you know, you can self-dedicate, but you can't self-initiate. Some, by definition, initiation is something someone else does to you, and it takes you from one state to another, usually from a child or an embryo or a larva or whatever into a full adult.
Okay? Well, and I would
maturation. Go ahead.
Sorry, I would add to that that initiation is really only applicable in a specific tradition. Or, you know, any given tradition, obviously. Whereas self-dedication or any of the practices that you could be involved with as a solitary, they don't necessarily have to adhere to a tradition, and therefore they're not necessarily invalidated. They're simply not part of a traditional way of doing things. It doesn't make them bad.
Right. Yeah, and when people start getting on to others about you're not initiated, they're right, because initiation is also a communal thing. It's introducing you to the group and the group to you. It's making sure everybody is comfortable. It's kind of like a wedding in some ways. And as a solitary, you just don't have that. It doesn't make your path any less something that is valid. It doesn't make what you're learning from the deities as you go through your life any less important. It doesn't mean that you're not going to learn all the same lessons. Because I'll tell you something, I have never been part of a coven, ever. I've always been solitary. I didn't know I was solitary, but I've been learning the lessons, and I've been talking to others, and I've been getting information, and we've been doing things like this, and I've been teaching others, and you're going to get all the same information. It just depends on, you know, how long it's going to take and how much dedication you give to it. There was a line in a book called One. Yeah, by Richard Bach. Okay, same guy that wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull and The Bridge Across Forever. And at one point, his wife Leslie looks at him and says, okay, imagine this. You really want to know what your existence is all about, okay? Imagine that. And he imagined himself, you know, as somebody who would go to any length to try to find out what this existence was about. He would go to any guru. He would look in any book, haunting libraries, talking to mystics, thinking and meditating about it. And once he got himself in that mindset, she said, can you imagine not finding out at that point? And that was like a soft hammer blow right between my eyes to me, because that's true. If you're going to dedicate yourself to it, and you're going to study, and you're going to continue, and you're going to work at it, and you're going to look, and you're going to talk, and you're going to be, and you're going to listen, you're going to find out. It's just, you know, up to you how much of your life you want to spend on it.
Exactly.
Oh. Okay, let me get a drink here. Okay, next topic. The modern ways are bad. This is one of those myths in paganism that can be deadly unless you're very, very careful. Modern ways are not bad. They are more efficient. That's it. Okay. For example, you have willow bark. And this is, you know, white willow bark. You pull it off the willow. You boil it up. It's it makes a tea. You drink it. Your headache goes away. Okay? That's great. What they did was they took that same chemical in the willow bark, and they distilled it out, and they concentrated it, and they focused it so that it works with one or two pills rather than having to drink gallons of this vile brew. And believe me, willow bark tea is vile. You don't want to drink it, okay? So that makes that more efficient. But here's something else. There's a plant called foxglove, okay, which is a beautiful flower. And if you drink a little bit of a tea made from this plant, heart arrhythmias are going to go away. Okay? Well, that's digitalis that is in there, at least as far as I can remember. Okay? And,
yeah,
and I understand I don't have my references in front of me. And digitalis is really, really good for tiny doses. If, however, you drink a lot of it, you're going to die, okay, because it is poison. And eschewing modern technology and modern measurements and modern ways of getting this digitalis out of the plant and into a form where it will help you instead of killing you is one of the hallmarks of modern civilization, okay? In the past, 200, 300, 500 years ago, if you drank too much of this stuff, you were going to die. And they had no accurate way of saying, okay, this much is enough, but this much is too much. I mean, because if you have a plant and you pull this flower off of this foxglove plant, and you pull that same flower off of another foxglove plant, the regional areas that they grew in could have made it stronger or less strong. And you had no way of telling by looking at the flowers which one was going to be stronger. Okay?
Very true.
Mistletoe. One of the reasons they think mistletoe is so sacred to the Druids is because they think that the Druids used it as a cure for cancer, certain types of cancer. And mistletoe is a very potent plant. It is a poison that will kill you, but in small enough doses, it will kill the cancer cells instead. Well, how did they get the poison into the cancer? Well, we don't know. Okay? We don't know how much they used. We don't know what they were using it for. Okay, and because we don't have that information, we're not using it in modern medicine. Another thing, here's another one, broken bones. Okay, you have a broken bone 1,000 years ago. Okay, it's bad. You splint it up, and you may hobble around on a crutch for the rest of your life. Okay, why? Because just putting a couple of boards on it and strapping it real tight will align the bones, but it's not going to be perfect. And you're going to have some misalignment with the setting. Along come x-rays, and now you can see inside the body, and you can actually align those properly. And people don't need crutches 10 years later. Then you have casts, which absolutely immobilize it. And then you have pins, where you can insert it into the bone to stabilize everything if it's bad enough. And then, you know, 1,000 years ago, somebody breaks their femur, they could die, even if they did everything right. They laid in bed for the 6 weeks it took for the bones to knit up, everything was aligned perfectly, they could still die. Why? Because the marrow could have gotten out of the core of their bone and into their bloodstream, which kills. Now, doctors know about this and about this effect, and they can fix it. And even if, you know, 1,000 years ago none of that was a factor, the person could still die because they bled out. Well, we got blood transfusions now. So just because the ways are old does not necessarily make them good. There is another quote out of another book. The ancient ways aren't necessarily wise. They're just ancient. Okay? If it works better and it's easier to do in the context of our society now, I would think that it would be better to do it that way. Now, there are times when you're trying to set a certain mood, and that's when you have to start being a little discriminatory. Use candles instead of the lamp, okay? Use a gold brass incense burner and charcoal rather than trying to light actual bundles of the herbs in the campfire, okay? But if you're trying to get an ancient feel, then by all means, do it outside. Do it with candles. Do it with a campfire, okay? Just be cognizant of the fact that you have to take extra precautions, and you have to pay attention to this stuff, okay? And don't automatically throw out the baby with the bathwater because, you know, willow bark tea tastes gross. I would much rather take a couple of Tylenol.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of herbal remedies do taste kind of unpleasant, but at the same time, I think there's a romance to the whole art that, you know, draws people to continue studying. I mean, otherwise there'd be more doctors.
Oh, yeah. So modern chemistry wouldn't exist if it weren't for them. So, you know, yeah, if y'all want to study that, go for it. You want to become the local herb guru? Certainly. And believe me, there's a lot that can be said for natural herbology and natural ways of doing things with healing and stuff, if nothing else, because there are a lot of chemicals that are used in the distillation processes and in the manufacture of the pills. There's, you know, contaminants. There's, you know, all this other stuff. And sometimes when you pull one chemical out that cures this one problem or helps with this one thing, you're creating 50 other problems because concentrating that one chemical down changes the entire chemistry of the body. So, yeah, it might be easier to do it with natural additives than it would be to try to take a pill for it. I'm just saying, you know, don't think that that just because it's old, it's automatically better. It's not necessarily so. And speaking of old, now we come to the history problems. And this is one that I'm going to lay right at the door of most Wiccans, okay? Wiccans don't know their own blessed history. The fact is this, Wicca, as we know it now, did not exist prior to 1950. Everybody who has studied it has traced everything back to Gerald Gardner somewhere in the late 40s, early 50s. There is multiple pieces of evidence showing that he wrote the rituals, mailed them out to people, had them proofread and suggest corrections, and mailed them back to them. According to Aidan Kelly, there are three different versions of the Gardnerian Book of Shadows, mainly because once Dorian Valente? I believe so.
Yeah.
Priestess?
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Came in, she rewrote all of the rituals so that they made sense. This is what saying that I have seen credible authors who in print and in serious tones of voice have stated that how Wiccans worship right now is exactly the same as the Indus people in the Sindh region of India worshipped at 10,000 BCE. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And my mind just blows up when I saw that. And what's worse is that there are people out there who believe that this is an ancient, verbally passed down tradition from the Ooz and the Druids, and that it's unchanged. I'm sorry, you can't do a game of telephone and have the statement be unchanged in 10 minutes. It's going to change over time. I don't care who you are. And now the phone's ringing. Okay. Nope. Not anybody I need to talk to. So you've got that situation going on, okay? You've got people that are crediting others with stealing things that they didn't. For instance, there's the idea that somehow Aleister Crowley stole everything from Gardner, okay? When there's lots of evidence showing that Gardner actually stole it all from Crowley and incorporated most of it into his religion. Now, does this invalidate Wicca? Hell no. It doesn't. Wicca is Wicca. It is a path that has brought happiness to millions of people, okay? But you can't ignore the stuff that you don't like. And as an example, Gardner's original writings, if you look at them, showed a very kinky slant to it. A couple of ceremonies in there where you're put into sensory deprivation, which looks a lot like a straitjacket.
That's true.
And then there's the focus on nudity and, you know, a couple of other things. It's theorized that he was into it, whether he was or not. We can't determine that. However, there's many, 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 many Wiccans these days who ignore that completely, going, oh, no, he was the master. He was, you know, this inspired writer. He was a guy, okay? He had his own things. He had his own hang-ups. He had his own way of thinking about this stuff. So if you're going to start teaching and start sharing Wicca and sharing this with your friends and trying to get them interested in it, not only don't gloss over the bad parts, but make sure you put everything in there. Because once again, if you're a representative for the gods and you're deliberately ignoring the bad parts, that, you know, kind of kills your credibility right there, and then it reflects badly on the rest of us. Because when we come along saying, no, that's not true, it was like this, then we get people going, well, so-and-so said whatever, and Silver Ravenwolf said that, you know, it was the seasons were backwards down in, that the sun rose in the west down in the southern hemisphere. And it's like, what? Where are you getting this? Okay? So know your history. Understand that that doesn't invalidate anything. It adds depth to it. So what that your religion is only less than a century old? Okay? That doesn't change anything. What I think part of the problem is that Gardner did go out and solicit the cunning men and women of the area that he was in when he was developing Wicca. Okay, so when you're talking about the cunning men and women, you're talking about the herbologists, you're talking about the people that were taught charms by their grannies, safeguarding against fairies so that the milk doesn't spoil. You're talking about the people that were the horse whisperers and had connections to animals. You're talking about the lore of the growing plants and things like that. And he encouraged them to come into Wicca and to share their knowledge with everybody. And all that got rolled into the body of what Wicca is now. Well, when they're saying, I learned how to understand what horses are doing from my great-grandmother who taught me before she died, that's implying that everything else that's with it, the herbalism and the EODO and the elemental chants were part of it as well, when it's not. It's one piece that's ancient, as opposed to the entire body.
That's true. And, I mean, the same could be said of anyone who chooses a particular skill to develop. I mean, in my own case, I'm fascinated by herbalism because, you know, it is cross-cultural. It is, you know, it traces its history back. But I also do understand that there are aspects of it that, you know, are best left in the past. You know, there's ideas that are completely dangerous. And there are ideas even that...
Racism.
Is there?
Just for one example.
Oh, you're talking...
No. You were talking about ideas better left in the past? No. Racism. There was a time when people of different races weren't allowed into Wicca. It was only for the English intelligentsia of this one little area. And black people weren't encouraged, you know. And there's, you know, a lot of black people in England, and they were kind of upset, you know. So ideas like that need to be left behind. Sorry, we've got about six more things to cover here and only a half hour to do it. So let's move on. Can't curse, can't heal. Okay. And this is one of those fallacies and myths that drives me crazy. It's also known as the universe is a friendly place, my child, meaning that if you have something bad going on in your life, the universe is going to help you fix it. Okay? Let me tell you a secret about the universe. The universe doesn't give a shit about you. It is neutral. It is literally survival of the fittest. Okay? Darwin was right, and those that deserve to live are the ones that fight for it. And we're not talking about on an individual level, okay? Because as far as nature and the universe is concerned, we could die out by the hundreds of millions as long as humanity went on. It would be considered a good experiment, okay? If you want this argument laid out very plainly and very in your face, read the Dorsai series, the child cycle, and I just drew a blank on the author's name, but it lays out this theory that there is a universal consciousness who doesn't care about its individual components. It just wants to survive, and part of the way it does that is by experimenting with living beings, okay? Not in a pull the wings off a fly's cool child type, but in a evolutionary type setting, okay?
Huh.
Because of this, the universe doesn't care if you lost your job. The universe doesn't care if you're about to lose your house. The universe doesn't care if your mother hates you, okay? The universe cares about surviving. The only person that is going to solve your problems is you. You can sit down and do all the spells you want to get a new job, but unless you put your resume out there, you're not going to get a job. It's not going to fall into your lap. And my addition to that is, and if it does drop into your lap, is it really a job that you want? Because usually those types are just the bottom of the barrel, terrible minimum wage ones, okay? And I've got a lot of room to talk. 2 months ago, I quit my job, and I don't have another one, and we're getting close to eviction here. So, you know, this is me saying that the only person that's going to fix this is me. And one of the things that I talked to Brian about before is there was another time when we were this desperate, and we had put $10 onto a gas card so that we could get gas at Sam's Club. And when I got there, I put the $10 in gas into my tank, and there was actually $100 on the card rather than 10. Well, then I've got a choice, because the immediate problem is that I didn't pay for it, so I'm essentially stealing $90. Granted, it's from Walmart, but that's still, you know, $90 that could go to pay somebody. Added to that is the poor kid who actually made the mistake and put the money on the card is going to get fired, because they come up $90 short in their drawer, okay? So through a lot of agonizing and a lot of soul searching, all about 10 minutes, I took the card back and they, you know, put the correct amount on there. I didn't get a thank you, no appreciation, no nothing. It was just, oh, yeah, okay. And the same kid, you know, couldn't have cared less. I told this story to a bunch of people later that day, and one of the comments that I got was, well, that was the universe trying to help you out. Okay, and no, that's not the universe trying to help me out. That's somebody making a mistake. And if it was just taking it from the corporation, I probably would have kept it. But because there was a kid involved who had nothing to do with it, simply made a human error, and in the process of punching it in, instead of hitting the 1, the 0, and the 00, hit 1000. He would have been affected, and his life would have been really, really changed. Couldn't justify, with my own moral code, doing that to him, even though I needed it. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of thing that where you have to actually understand that consequences happen, all right? There is no such thing as a free lunch, chance to fall, all right? Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. There are consequences to every action. You do something, and someplace else, something moves, okay? I don't care how inconsequential this is. And this is the actual meaning of the read and the law of three, which we'll get to in just a second. It's not about doing no harm. It's about doing the least amount of harm you can. It's about understanding that there are going to be consequences to your action and trying to mitigate those as much as possible. And then understanding that even after all that's done, there's going to be consequences that you haven't thought about, and understanding that you're going to be responsible for them and accepting that and then doing the action. That's what the read is about. That's what the threefold return is about, okay? It's about those concepts. It's not about a couplet that you can give to the Catholic minister when he starts screaming about how you're a witch, okay? It's about understanding the series of consequences and doing your best to make sure that you harm the least possible, because there's always going to be harm done. You got anything, Brian?
No, that's pretty clearly covered it. Yeah, I mean, the simple reality is, it can really test your personal convictions, your personal ethics, to fall into a situation that there are certain people who will dismiss it as, you know, a gift from the universe, etc. But the reality is, you do have to think about the way in which your actions will harm another person. Sometimes it's you know, a frivolous thing. Sometimes it's a case like Joy mentioned, where, you know, a person's job is at stake. And, you know, actually, I posted about this the other day, you know, talking about the simple reality that people tend to think that their personal spiritual journey is somehow making them better than other people, you know, making them more aware, making them more amazing as people. The simple reality is, the universe couldn't give less of a shit. Your spiritual journey is for you alone. If that results in you doing harm, or, you know, becoming accomplice to harm being done to people, then your spiritual journey is bullshit. It's wrong, it's evil and terrible. If, however, you know, your spiritual journey isn't doing any harm at all, or is doing minimal, if any, harm, or even benefiting other people, that's awesome. The universe couldn't care less either way. Doesn't make you special. Mm-hmm. It simply is. You know, your spiritual journey should benefit you. If it benefits others, awesome. But don't kid yourself into thinking the universe gives a shit.
Yeah. And that's a perfect segue into one of the main points that I wanted to cover through all of this. And we wanted to try to put this towards the end so that y'all can just melt down in the chat room, call in, start screaming at us or whatever. Because this is a big one. This is the not my kink fallacy. And when I say that, that's in the adult areas where you understand that you have your enjoyment and that they have their enjoyment and that what they enjoy is not necessarily something that's going to get your rocks off. But then you go, okay, that's what they enjoy and it's not my kink, but they can have fun at it, okay? And for paganism, I modified this to the Reed fallacy, okay? Because I know that just about everybody who's non-Wiccan right now is just nodding their head in agreement because they have encountered this. You have a book on Druidism or you have a book on Asatru and you're reading through it and you get to morals of whatever. And the author says, and it harm none, do as you will. And I get to that point in the book, and I throw it across the room and give it a very low score. Why? Because the Reed is only part of Wicca. It was a poem that came up 20 years after Gardner created Wicca and was published in one magazine, and people decided to run with it because it's nice. Okay, it's a way to talk about the law of consequences, okay? But it didn't exist before then. And to say that this is something that is pan-pagan is ludicrous because it's not. It is not a concept in Druidism. It is not a concept in Asatru. It is not a concept in any other pagan path that you can mention, okay? There are moral codes similar to it. And most easily explained is the law of consequences, okay? You do this action, this happens, okay? You do have to think about it, okay? Well, that's just like the Reed. No, it's not. The Reed is 27 lines, of which the last two lines are the ones that are always quoted. And a lot of times it's boiled down to two words, harm none, which is bullshit because you can't harm none. Just the simple act of breathing kills bacteria. If you're going to harm none, you can't kill them. So it's impossible to do. Okay? So you've got to understand that your moral code is your moral code. It may not be somebody else's moral code, and you have absolutely no right to inflict your moral code or your beliefs on another person because your journey is not their journey. And the two should constantly remain separate. Always understand that your journey and your mindset and your beliefs are yours and yours alone. And I'll tell you something even more secret. Your beliefs are yours, and a coven member that is standing right next to you, been educated with you, been to all the same classes as you, had no other anything other than what you experienced when y'all started studying this, is going to have a different journey and a different interpretation of that same stuff simply because they have a different background story.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get that information into their brain, they're going to interpret it through the lens of everything that they've lived before, and their beliefs are going to be different from yours, even when you're practicing exactly the same. And you have no right to say that they're wrong. They have no right to say that you're wrong.
Exactly.
That's the big one that I wanted to cover. Other than
that,
that is a big one. Not all cats are familiars. Yeah, and it's one of those things that, you know, you would think that people who actually had intelligence would realize, but then you see, you know, the Tea Party trying to make sure that no woman can get an abortion anywhere in the United States. Because their moral code says that a baby's a baby at conception. Well, that's great that, you know, you've got a that you want to protect a collection of cells that have absolutely nothing to do with anything and is, in fact, at that point in time, a parasite. I don't happen to believe that way, and you have no right to try to force it. Well, they're making laws all over the place to try to force it. So,
exactly.
You know, this is you've got idiots that are doing this all over. We don't need to do it amongst ourselves. Understand that their journey is going to be their journey, and let them live their journey the way their conscience dictates. Thomas Jefferson, one of the things that he said was, it makes no difference to me whether my neighbor says there are no God or nine gods or 100 gods. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my arm. And you know what? That's about as best as you can say it.
True. I mean, even, you know, actually, it's something that druids say all the time. You know, you ask a question and two druids will give five answers.
True.
It's just the way it is. You know, you can't hold your path above anyone else's because each of us is different. Every path is different. You know, our paths may parallel for a while or, you know, for a hell of a long time, but it doesn't mean they're the same.
Exactly. And that's what
yeah.
it should be.
Oh, of course. I mean, there would be no point in, you know, walking a spiritual journey if I was going to be walking the same one as everyone else before me. I mean, that would be no fun. It would become, mm-hmm. you know, a redundant, pointless exercise in, well, regurgitating previous knowledge.
Yeah, spiritual journeys are designed to improve the person undergoing them. A religion is a tool for a spiritual journey. Off the shelf, one size fits all religions don't improve anybody because they are one size fits all.
It's true.
The only
they
way
assume that everyone is the same.
And that may be fine for the way you worship. For the dogma, for the deities, for the teachings, but it's going to change depending upon who is doing the worshiping and who's during the journey, because experiences change from person to person.
Exactly.
All right.
All cats are familiar. You alluded
points.
Them.
Yes. All cats are familiars. They are not. Cats are cats, and cats are pets, and I know quite a number of pets who are not familiars. I've got two of them. A familiar is a specific help in a physical form in front of you for a religious journey. Okay, now they can either help you energy-wise while you're going through a ritual or a spell or something like that. They can contain part of your energy, kind of like a metaphysical battery. They can share their senses with you. Okay, that's what a familiar is. A pet who loves you and is all over you and is in your face with everything is not a familiar. Okay, I've got two of them that are crawling all over me. They don't do this during circle, but they do this all day, every day, because I sit here and they want food. Okay? That makes them a pet. That makes them friends. That makes them things that you take care of and who care for you and love you. All right? Same for dogs, same for snakes, lizards, horses.
A pet is one that allows you to serve it. A familiar serves you in the astral plane.
Well, a familiar is more of a partner than anything else.
This is true.
I mean, I haven't ever, you know, reading the medieval grimoires about familiars, the way they describe them is almost as a spirit from another plane comes here and deliberately embodies so that they can be with you and experience a life and share with you the otherworldly energies, okay? And with reincarnation, that's very, very possible, okay? But that's what a familiar is. Also in the Bible, it's King Saul is talking about going and finding a woman with a familiar spirit, okay? This doesn't necessarily imply that this is a physical form, okay? What this could be is some weird woman or somebody from a spae wife or something like that who has a better connection with the spirits than he does, okay? And
true.
It's a spirit that is familiar to the person that's doing the divining. So that's
true.
What a familiar is. It's a partner in this journey and a help. By that definition, I've got about three, all of them on the astral. They talk to me. I listen to them. They, you know, help me out. I share with them. I teach them. I learn from them. You know, so it depends. Partners, but all cats are not familiars, all dogs are not familiars. These are very, very special creatures that you should feel very honored to have. Last is knives will sever a relationship. This isn't one of the big myths, but it's common enough that I thought we should talk about it, because a knife is a knife, and if your relationship is going to crap, a knife is not going to make it worse. If you have a good relationship with your friend, giving them a knife is not going to destroy it, because it's a knife. Okay?
It's true.
It has the significance you put on it. Right. And the main point that all of these have in common is what you believe is so. It is will. Will above everything else. Okay? Crowley got this one right. Will above all, all right? What you believe, what you internalize, what you hold as so is what will be so for you. If you think that for some reason you can't cast magic while you have green on, because that's what the contemplative order of the leaves taught you 25 years ago, then having green on is not going to let you cast magic. You're going to have to either get rid of that belief, or you're going to have to work around it. Okay?
That ties really well, actually, to the whole not my kink thing. It also ties really well to the concept of consecrated tools. That was also in our little list of topics. And I think, you know, just to briefly touch on that, I mean, there are people who will go all out with little rituals to make their particular working tools very special or sacred or what have you, who don't want you to touch them. Okay. Again, that falls into the not my kink thing. It falls into the concept of a knife is just a knife. You should be able to do magical workings or any other spiritual stuff without trinkets and gadgets and knickknacks and such. But, you know, if you feel that they enhance your work, awesome, use them, you know. But don't shit on people who are, like, nonchalant about their tools. Like, I tend not to be the type who's, like, wrapping my tarot decks in silk and, you know, keeping them in dark places and blah, blah, blah. I simply leave out, you know, my decks. And if people want to fiddle around with them, they're more than welcome. Not everyone's like that.
Because in kitchen witchcraft, that has actually come down, you know, the herbalism and everything and using your magic in the kitchen. The ritual tools that they had were the same things that they would carve up the chicken with. You know,
well, exactly.
So it's not, you know, they used what was on hand, and they were only special because that's what they were using in that ritual. It wasn't that they had I know of no peasant cottages where they practiced green magic, helping the fields grow, where they had a sword for the community. I mean, they might have had an old rusted one, But, you know, to hear some witches talk, it's a requirement for every solitary. And I've got one hanging on my wall. I've used it once in a ritual. You know, you use what you have, and you don't worry about it. But if you want to use a special consecrated one, hey, not my kink, go for it.
Exactly. You know, if you want to use a ritual scourge that you've, you know, engraved with special runes, awesome. If you want to use the same toy that you play with in the bedroom, go for it. It has the significance in
and
the
we're
moment
gonna be talking
that you
about
give
that
it.
In another...
This is so
yeah,
true.
We're going to be talking
yeah.
about that in another show.
This is true.
Okay. That's everything, and we have 5 minutes left. So now we get the closing credits and the closing ads. If you like this, hey, you know, follow us on our blog, magicalmusings.net, all one word, no K. We're going to post not only this piece, this blog, my brain just shut down, this podcast on there as an archive. But we occasionally, there's a chat form there. There's contact information for us. Don't be afraid to come there, talk to us. If you like this, the best advertising that we have is your word of mouth. Tell others. So you got to listen to the show and drag them into, you know, listening, whatever. The more listeners, the better. Mention us on your
blogs.
Own personal blogs, your own websites, your chat forums, you know, wherever, and spread the word.
If you
you want to throw
episodes?
A little money at us.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Donations
yes.
always
yes.
appreciated. You know, we don't formally do it, but, you know, you could imagine a nice little empty hat tossed out on the curb in front of us. Donations do help us.
Best way you can say thank you is putting a few coins in because, you know, this costs money out of our pockets. And like I told you, I don't have a job now. So, you know, I'm hoping
True.
That we can either sell ad space or try to, you know, get a little income going here.
Exactly. Also, each of us has blogs on Tumblr that you can hit us up on. You can also email us, Brian or Joy at magicalmusings.net. And Joy's blog is Wide Worlds Joy, hyphenated in between. And mine is Cosmic Rebirth, hyphenated. You can hit us up on Tumblr.
Tumblr.com.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
that too. You can,
yeah.
you know, hit us up in email, call into the show on Blog Talk Radio on the show nights. You know, just
if you have a
pagan
related Etsy short store, we have advertising space. Feel free to contact us, and we'll talk about terms. And, you know, we're here. If there's a topic that we didn't cover that you would like to hear in a future show, because believe me, we could probably go through lots of this, email us that. Tell us that in the forum. Our broadcast calendar is also on our website. So if you want to find out what we're going to be talking about in 2 weeks, it's there, and you'll be able to, you know, schedule for listening in and whatever.
Exactly.
So,
other than that, folks, we want to thank you for joining us tonight and invite you to join us next week for the Samhain show. That should be really fascinating.
Oh, yes.
Samhain's awesome, and, you know, it's going to be interesting. So join us next week. Thank you again for joining us tonight. And if you happen to download this to listen to in the future, share it with everyone you know. We love having feedback. Don't forget to get in touch with us if you like stuff or hate it. We want to know. Thank you again. Have a great night.
Bye.
Bye-bye, folks.